Hello and welcome to An Incomplete History.
I'm Hillary.
And I'm Jeff.
We're your hosts for this weekly history podcast.
All right. Well, Hillary, I know one of your favorite holidays is coming up soon.
It's not. when you asked me to do this podcast, your first idea was like, well, we should do something about Halloween. And I'm like, I really don't like Halloween at all. I mean, I like what we're going to discuss today, but I'm just not a Halloween fan. So it was interesting that you pitched that to me.
Right. I mean, you hate orange and black together.
I think it's a worse color combination.
Green and red is pretty hideous.
I don't like that either.
Oh, okay.
And I like if gingers wear green, I think that it's not a good look.
Oh, no.
Well, it's like if I wear red, so I have blonde hair, and if I wear red, I think I look like ketchup and mustard, and I don't think that's a good look either.
All right. So, well, I mean, today's episode is Halloween related, kind of a little bit, but not really, right?
No, it's not Halloween related. I'm going to just keep saying it's not Halloween related, but I guess it's thematic because, you know, if we talk about Halloween and witches and stuff, I mean, it does make sense. But.
Well, see, you said the word. And
no.
I promise I won't play that sound effect too much. Today we're talking about the Salem Witchcraft Trials. And that's part of a kind of a bigger conversation we want to have about kind of public memory, but kind of how historians do what they do and how our approaches to historical events change over time. And I think we want to get to a place where we kind of talk about an event that really is centered around the bodies of women in a lot of ways and how male historians have approached that differently than female historians, right?
Right. And we're going to talk about the Elizabeth Reese book, Damned Women, Sinners and Witches in Puritan New England, to kind of center our conversations, what we had discussed. And what I really enjoyed about reading this is because we're talking about, you said, the Salem witch trials, but also just like, what is witchcraft and what is the memory of it in the United States? And is it placed outside of Salem as well? And Reese does a nice job describing that, you know, it's in Connecticut, even before the late 17th century crisis that we are familiar with in our public memory. And it's important also to remember that this is something that is happening throughout Europe, all throughout the early modern era. So covering that and thinking about women's bodies and how women are accused of this, it's interesting to think about what that means for historians and how we've looked at it.
Right. Well, I mean, so you want me to start off with kind of a Jeff's story time?
Yeah, I would love that.
All right. So let's get a little ambiance there. I promised Hillary I wouldn't do many sound effects. January 1692, Reverend Paris, so he's the Reverend of Salem Township. His daughter, Elizabeth, she was 9, and his niece, Abigail Williams, who was 11, started having these fits. And they would scream, they would throw things, they would utter peculiar sounds. They would also place themselves in really strange positions. And a local doctor said, well, this is obviously the result of supernatural effects. Something supernatural is going on here. About the same time, another girl in the town, Ann Putnam, also 11, experienced similar episodes. And by February of 29th of 1692, so by the end of the next month, town magistrates John Corwin and John Haythorne kind of may have pressured the girls to name who was afflicting them. So this supernatural event was caused by people. That was the kind of the conclusion. And the girls blamed three women. So they blamed Sarah Osborne, and she was an elderly woman. She was impoverished, living in Salem Township. They blamed Sarah Good, who may have been a homeless beggar. And then they blamed Tituba. And Tituba was the Paris's house slave. She was a Caribbean woman. And all three of these women were brought before magistrates and interrogated for several days, starting March 4th, 1692. So when you talk about the Salem witch trials, if you actually want to talk about when the trials start, March 1st, 1692, it's a good date. Osborne said she was innocent. So did Good. But Tituba confessed that she'd engaged in elaborate rituals and that the devil had come to her and bid her to serve him well. She talks about black dogs, red cats, yellow birds, and a black man who wanted her to sign his book. And she admitted that she signed the book and said there were several other witches looking to destroy the Puritans. All three women were subsequently put in a jail. So with this seed of paranoia kind of planted, accusations started streaming all over the town over the next few months. Martha Corey, a loyal member of the church, was accused. And once Corey gets accused, the floodgates kind of open. Basically, anybody can be accused of witchcraft at this point. They even questioned Good's four-year-old daughter, and her timidity during questioning was construed as a kind of tentative confession of service to Satan. And it got more serious in April when Governor Thomas Danforth and his assistants attended the hearings. Dozens of people from Salem and adjoining Massachusetts villages were brought in for questioning. Finally, in May of 1692, William Phipps, who was the governor of Massachusetts, ordered the establishment of a special court to hear and decide these cases. And it would cover Suffolk, Essex, and Middlesex counties. The first case brought to the special court was Bridget Bishop. She's an older woman known for her gossipy habits, and she may have been promiscuous as well. And when she was asked if she committed witchcraft, Bishop responded, "I am as innocent as the child unborn." However, she was still found guilty, and on June 10th, she became the first person executed during the Salem witch trials. She was hanged at a place called Gallows Hill. 5 days later, Cotton Mather wrote a scathing letter imploring the court not to allow spectral evidence. This is evidence that's based on dreams and vision testimony. The court ignored this request, and five people were sentenced and hanged in July, five more in August, and another eighth by the end of September. By October 3rd of 1692, following in his son's footsteps, Increase Mather, then president of Harvard, again denounced the use of spectral evidence, and he said it were better that 10 suspected witches should escape than one innocent person be condemned. So remember, Phipps had kind of encouraged the trials up to this point, but in response to Mather's plea, but in my opinion, in response to his own wife being accused of witchcraft, Phipps prohibited further arrest, released many of the still living accused witches, and dissolved the court on October 29th, 1692. He replaced it with a superior court, which disallowed spectral evidence and only condemned three of the remaining 56 defendants. He eventually pardoned all who were in prison on witchcraft charges by May of the next year, but the damage had been done. 19 people had been hanged on Gallows Hill. A 71-year-old man, Giles Corey, had been pressed to death with heavy stones. Several people had died in jail, and nearly 200 people had been accused of practicing the devil's magic. Now, even before 1700, there had been kind of apologies that had been made and kind of people trying to distance themselves from this whole thing. In fact, by 1711, the colony restored rights and good names of all those accused and granted a 600-pound restitution to heirs of those who had died. But it's not until 1957, 250 years later, that the state of Massachusetts formally apologized for 1692.
Wow, that took a long time to acknowledge. It's kind of like the Catholic Church apologizing.
Yeah. Seriously. I mean, it's mind-boggling that it took what's surprising is they apologize so quickly right after it happens. They do kind of an initial apology. And within a couple of decades, they're offering a pretty sizable amount of money to people who got executed.
But then it's another. What do they say, though? I mean, what is the explanation for this that they give at that moment?
I think Well, I mean, people believed Satan was active, right? And there was this suspicion. I mean, even Cotton Mather and Increase Mathers, even there's kind of their kind of rejection of spectral evidence, they still believed Satan was active. Their problem was they did not want innocents caught up in this web. And, you know, their mindset was such that Satan worked in such kind of devious ways that he could be tricking the people of Salem and Massachusetts more broadly into executing people who were innocent, who were like God-fearing Christians.
Right. Well, and in addition to that, I mean, I think that they started to perceive the people, even if they were active in, you know, performing some form of witchcraft, as victims themselves, right?
Right, like, right.
They couldn't help that they had succumbed to this. I mean,
I think that's where Reese eventually gets, right, in history. Yeah. And the historiography eventually gets to kind of recognizing that. But I think early on, it's very much considered a mistake. And I think after that, kind of as historians start to wrestle with this issue, kind of the first big wave is this idea that, look, Salem in 1692 is a pre-Enlightenment space. And it's an easy way for people in the 19th century to look back at 1692 and say, we're modern, they weren't. You know, they had this old way of viewing the world. They believed that witches were active. They believed that Satan could trick people into signing this book. And that persisted for a long time. In fact, a lot of historians would argue that still dominates the public discourse over the Salem witchcraft trials. It's a comfortable way for us to feel we're very different than those people were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, but thinking about current politics, not to get too into it, but I mean, you still hear the phrase witch hunt, right?
Right.
It's like, it's the connotation of it of itself is just like that it's some form of mass hysteria that takes place.
Right.
And
right.
I think, go ahead.
Well, Sarah Rivett writes about this, William & Mary Quarterly in 2008. She wrote an article called Our Salem Ourselves, where she kind of says, we want to see Salem as this uniquely American thing because we want to use it to say how we react to it. So basically, Salem and kind of these witch trial hysterias that follow, including things like McCarthyism and even contemporary accusations of witch trials, is an opportunity for us to, once we resolve it, to say, ooh, weren't we really backwards in our thinking before we fixed that? And I think particularly McCarthyism, which is most closely linked to the Salem witchcraft trials via, you know, the Crucible, among other things, is this idea that, look, those people were so ridiculous in what they did.
Well, but I think it's important to point out, too, though, that it's not uniquely American. It's actually well situated, you know,
in the time period.
I mean, it's what happens in Salem is a little bit later than what had been happening throughout Europe. It's not uniquely American. And actually, it's kind of witchcraft trials light because there's just not even a huge number of people who are tried and executed for it. Whereas in Europe, I mean, it's just thousands. And it's
tens of thousands.
Oh, yeah. And it's very much motivated, though, by the Catholic Church. And what's different about it in the United States, though, is it comes out of this Puritanism. And I think that's what Reese gets at so well, is talking about the function and role of religion in this period, in this space, and how it functions for the people living in Salem and in Connecticut, you know, that are on trial for witchcraft.
Right. So I think Reese is this really interesting. She sits kind of in the middle of the historiography, and I think it might be useful to kind of talk about who comes before her and what they say, because I think it really makes what she starts to say even more important. Mm-hmm. So usually the person who's kind of highlighted as the one who kind of starts to change the way we approach Salem is G.L. Kittredge in 1929 with Witchcraft and Old in New England. And he starts to do this bottom-up approach. And he's got this great quote in the book where he says, things like the witchcraft trials never flourish unless the common people are eager for it. So, I mean, what he says is this isn't a product of elites making this happen in the town. In fact, he argues the elites are very reticent to do this, that he argues this is just the workaday Salemite who kind of drives this. And he says it's their political anxiety manifesting in accusations against people that they see as violating community standards, which is why you get Tituba accused, why you get Sarah Good, who's a beggar, why you get Sarah Osborne, who's this elderly impoverished woman. It's why they get accused, right? He starts to kind of move the conversation a little bit about, well, let's actually talk about where these accusations are coming from.
Well, he's making a little bit more of a class-based argument too. And
he is.
He's not quite at the gender space, but.
No, definitely. I mean, there's an interesting thing. Does he accidentally start to approach it from a more gendered perspective?
Accidentally, yeah. Definitely.
I mean, maybe, right? He's an accidental gender historian, maybe.
I think for the 1920s, I mean, any mention of it is sort of pioneering, of course, in the field of American history. So I think it's important to extend some credit there.
Right. And then I think the next big thing to talk about are Keith Thomas, Alan McFarlane, and then Paul Boyer and Stephen Nissenbaum. And these are all early 1970s historians. Mm-hmm. Boyer and Nissenbaum co-write Salem Possessed, The Social Origins of Witchcraft. And it's really this, for historians, for academics, it really is like the bedrock on which we build how we approach this, right? I still see this referenced in textbooks. I still hear historians, when they talk about it, focus on this, and they argue it's a rural-urban conflict, and that it's this pro-Paris group who's in favor of the trials and this anti-Paris group who don't like it. And they really push back against class as the deciding factor. They actually argue if you're wealthy and you live in the town, you're much more likely to agree with poor people in the town versus if you live in the rural spaces, you have a different perspective, right? It's interesting that these are male historians making these arguments. And 74, I mean, it would have been a hard sell for them to do a gendered approach, but they kind of explicitly reject it. Hmm. Right? And they put Paris really at the center of this whole conversation.
But it's really is difficult to ignore that it is predominantly women who are accused of, tried and executed for witchcraft. And it's not until you see women who enter the academy in larger numbers in the 80s and, of course, in the 90s that you start having women, female historians ask questions about, well, wait a minute, let's talk about why is this happening to women? And it's what I really like about Reese's analysis is it's not a victim approach.
No, not at all.
She's not going at it saying, well, men are just so evil and awful that, of course, they're persecuting women. It's so much more nuanced than that. And I really like her approach. Can I get into that a little bit?
Well, Reese writes, Damned Woman comes out in 97. Carol Carlson's Devil in the Shape of a Woman comes out almost at the same time, 98. And these are I would argue these are the first two really strong gendered approaches to looking at this event. And it's interesting you said that Reese has this kind of non-victim approach to understanding it. Carlson, on the other hand, she calls these women demographic accidents, right? She says that these are women who are violating gender norms in Salem for whatever reason. And it has to do with, you know, maybe they are the wife of a wealthy man with no inheriting males. And they're causing this kind of economic stress in the community. That's part of her argument. But Reese is really different, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about what Reese's, what her big things are.
Well, I really like how she nods to Ulrich and her
Laurel
analysis.
Laurel Thatcher Ulrich.
Yes, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. She nods to her analysis of In a Midwife's Tale by saying that people who are studying this period have actually uncovered that it's not as oppressive as we might have considered it to be for women, that there was actually a little bit more fluidity in the types of things that women would do on a day-to-day basis, and that their participation in the social sphere could extend based on the needs of their family. And in this period, in this space, because things are nascent in terms of being established, it does allow for a little bit more flexibility in the space of women. And because of that, I think that women become subject to more scrutiny, perhaps. But she doesn't go in that direction to say it's about victims, you know, a sense of victimness. But she goes in the direction to talk about, well, it's religion really that spurs this. And
right.
It's women's beliefs about themselves. So this is a patriarchal society, but patriarchy only works with the participation of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just as much the participation of the women who are being accused and who are accusing one another. And it's just as much about their participation and understanding of religion and understanding of themselves or their perceptions of themselves that helps spur the hysteria as well. So she makes arguments about women perceiving themselves and when perceiving women to be more susceptible to influence from the spiritual world, therefore more susceptible to the devil being able to coerce. They feel that women are more susceptible because they're physically weaker, mentally weaker. But it's not just men who are assigning these characteristics to women. It's women who believe it about themselves and believe it about others. And so she gets into this really nuanced discussion about these deeply held beliefs about self that kind of propel this hysteria and incident into, you know, it sort of snowballs out of control, but it's all very deeply rooted in these religious beliefs and this religious ideology about womanhood and what it means to be a woman and a Christian woman.
Right. I mean, I think that's, for me, this is why this stands out as one of the outstanding works on the events of 1692, is that when you and I first discussed this book years ago, I had said all the works prior to Reese had really seen religion as kind of this smokescreen for other things, whether it was economic, political, maintaining social order, punishing people viewed as deviant to society's rules, that religion was always kind of a smokescreen. And Reese steps back and says, no, look, we have to take people on their own terrain on some level. And she's got this great quote I want to read really quickly. And it's early in the book. And this is when I first read this book. This is when I knew she was saying something original. She says, because it's difficult to imagine the sensibilities of 17th century Puritans, to understand the intensity of reality of their fears, I find the admittedly imperfect analogy of the sexual abuse of children useful. In today's world, we live with the knowledge that many children are victims of such abuse. As parents, we warn our children about the dangers and teach them how to respond to such situations. The charge that someone, a teacher, daycare worker, relative, has made sexual advances cannot be taken lightly. The Puritan fear of Satan's threat was just as real to them. The charge that someone was a witch just as serious. Although the demons are different, the sense of threat is the same, and it ignites similar fear and action. I mean, for me, I think that sums it up perfectly.
Well, that's a really nice way to put it for modern readers to understand it and to understand just how deeply embedded and real religion was to people in this moment, in this period, that it's not something that's happening just on Sunday, but it's something that's just very much a part of every moment of their lives. And I think that really does help sum it up.
Well, I mean, it's the thing is, one of the problems historians have to figure out is, why do we have some women confessing, right? We've got some women who seem to confess rapidly, and why do they do that? And Reese's explanation is, look, they understood how Satan worked, right? And they knew that even though they might think there's no way I would have done this, this Puritan mindset says to them, you know, ooh, this might be Satan's real trick. Yeah. And maybe I really am a witch.
But, and there's also this idea, and the title of the book really points to it, is Damned Women, is kind of a damned if you do and damned if you don't sort of thing. I mean, if they admit to it and say, yes, I've had, you know, communion with the devil, and, you know, he's asked me to do X, Y, or Z, and I've done it, this could help save her. Because then they can say, well, we're going to exorcise you or something. And then we're going to, you know, you ask for forgiveness and all that. But if she denies it, then they think that the devil's still working in her and she's still subject to execution. So the title of the book really kind of gets at that also, of just like, it's difficult to escape the accusation once it's launched. And women, when they're accused, I think they internalize it as being, well, this is definitely a possibility that this happened, because again, the devil's real and working, and, you know, we're working against the devil all the time. But, you know, so there's just this idea that they internalize it as a part of it, but also that they're so ready and willing to accuse others. Right. They're ready and willing to accuse their neighbors, even knowing of the consequences of it. But that because it's such a deeply embedded fear, they're willing to take that leap.
Right, right. Well, I mean, let's talk a little bit then about, so 97, Reese's book comes out. Carol Carlson's Devil in the Shape of the Woman comes out in 1998. And then we get kind of some other pieces. James Sharp writes Witchcraft in Early Modern England in 2001. But in 2003, we get The Devil's Snare, Mary Beth Norton. And I know you have some strong feelings on this book as well, right?
I do. What specifically are you asking?
Well, so, I mean, Mary Beth Norton doesn't reject a gendered approach. However, she does kind of reject the religious approach that Reese takes, right? And she actually situates it in the context of war, right? And she... I mean, this idea that Salem is, we have to view Salem as part of a broader world and look at connections. And she actually argues more of this is a result of externalities, things happening outside of Salem, specifically up in the Maine frontier, right?
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think she also situates it in the broader scope, where she's, what I had kind of mentioned earlier, of just like, this is something that's endemic globally. And, oh, I mean, in the European world and European space, I guess, but it's just like this, yeah, that this is a product of something that's much larger than Salem, or much larger than, you know, any region where there's, where there's a crisis occurring. Because she kind of revises the standard chronology of the trials, and she enlarges it to be this a more political context. And I don't think she's dismissive of religion, but I think she just sees there are other external forces.
Right. I mean, it's, you can kind of, I summarize Mary Beth Norton's approach when I kind of talk to people about this. It's, she says it's post-traumatic stress syndrome, right?
Right, because she's talking about the wars and conflicts with Native people, and that this is creating just, I guess they wouldn't call it that, but yes, in the 21st century context, it is somewhat of a post-traumatic stress.
Right, and if you read, I think if you read early captivity, if you read like Mary Brolinson's captivity narrative, you can get to maybe a little bit of that mindset, right? I mean, if you read Devil's Snare and Mary Rowlandson's narrative in tandem with one another, you can kind of buy it, and you can be like, wow, if that happened to me, maybe I'd be a little paranoid too.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, she does bring up an interesting political thing though, because George Burroughs, who gets accused of witchcraft, he had been a minister in Salem, but had removed to the main frontier. And she makes an argument that there's a strong chance Abigail Hobbs, who was an accuser, knew or had an encounter with Burroughs there, right? And I think it's interesting, these kind of connections she creates. And it's an interesting broader connection to kind of the First and Second Indian Wars, and kind of how does society process that. It takes it in a very unexpected direction.
Yeah, it's certainly a different conversation that's had, because even when you're talking about some of the historians of the 1970s and even back further, you mentioned the historian of the 1920s, like never has this approach been taken to explain the crisis as being not one of extreme religiosity or fervor, and not one of women as victims, and not one as a product of, you know, misogyny or patriarchy or something, but it's just
ergo poisoning.
Yeah, it's just one of, look at the context of the late 17th century. The people who are living in this time and in this place are being terrorized. They feel, you know, like they're just constantly under attack. They're, you know, trying to rough it in the most, unfriendly of circumstances, really. And,
right.
And that it, this hysteria is spurred by that context and that trauma. And it, she does really expand the scope of the trials. She expands the scope of the trials as being part of a larger context in ways that I don't think other books do that. I mean, it's tough to do that.
Well,
and I respect
James,
it though.
James Sharp does in his Witchcraft in Early Modern England. He really argues that, look, to understand the witchcraft trials, there it's kind of variations on all these different themes. You kind of, it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of that. And I mean, that's kind of where how I teach it. Is look, it's maybe all of these things combined, and to kind of try to pinpoint any one cause is missing the point,
right?
But I think it's interesting to push back against teaching this as the last moment of kind of early modern America, because that really plays into this whole idea of that Rivet criticizes, right? That, oh, look, we can point back to it and say, weren't they primitive?
Yeah, and suddenly there's this transformative moment or something, and is used as sort of a signpost, which is...
Right, and 84 years later, we're writing the Declaration of Independence, and we've just left that awful history behind us.
Right after that, I mean, my goodness, yeah. I mean, that's just a silly way to look at it. You know, it's like there's some upward trajectory that's happening, but it is situated in this moment, most certainly. But yeah, to try to look back and say, well, that was silly, it's not only dismissive, but it's not understanding the context. Now, how does this relate though to Halloween? Like, what, you know, we're doing this episode very specifically in October.
Right.
Why?
Well, I mean, it's why. So when I teach the U.S. introductory sequence, I love to have a witch lecture. A professor of mine in grad school, who you had also, I will mention him by name some point, but he said, like, witches are one of the easy entries into the public imagination. You can teach them broader historical things with this kind of entry point of witches. And I really do find that true. I can talk, witches are a much easier way for me to talk about the Puritan mindset and what life was like in Puritan America than me just kind of launching into that conversation on its own. Because students are already interested in it, right?
Well, yeah. Hocus pocus, really.
Hocus Pocus, although increasingly more, I point students to The Witch. It's a more recent movie.
Hocus Pocus is better, though.
Okay.
It's the only thing I like about Halloween.
Okay.
I like movie. Yeah.
Don't look on Rotten Tomatoes.
It came out when I was five. Or no, I wasn't five. I was four. And I was very, I remember sitting down and watching the premiere on the Disney Channel of Hocus Pocus. And that's the only thing I've ever liked about Halloween.
Did you ever dress as a Sanderson sister?
No. No, I didn't dress as scary things. Like, because I don't like.
Are the Sandersons scary? I don't like
the scary things. Well, they're witches. I mean, so kind of getting back to this idea though about Salem and about religion and about religiosity. I mean, I was raised religiously, and like, I guess I just don't think Halloween's a joke, you know?
Oh, okay.
I guess that's how it kind of comes from, but I'm also just kind of a chicken, but I don't think it's funny to talk about.
I mean, it'd be interesting to have a conversation with Mathers.
Yeah.
Have a conversation with the Mathers and ask Cotton and Increase what they think about Halloween.
Yeah, they'd probably be like, well, this isn't funny at all. This is no laughing matter, you know?
Right.
Maybe that's where it comes from for me. But I just think that it's the color combination. But you know what I do love?
The specters are coming. We're going to have to wrap it up. Finish your thought, and then we'll wrap it up.
What I do love is fall, because I'm, you know, a white woman. I mean, we love fall, but I love the fall colors.
What are they calling it this year? What's the thing? What's it? Something fall? Something autumn? Something white woman autumn or something? Some hashtag.
I don't know. It's some sort of way to, you know, talk poorly about. Anyway, I do like the fall colors, but I don't like black and orange. Anyway, we can cut this out.
Why would we cut this out? This is great. I mean, any parting words you want to say about the Salem Witchcraft Trials, Halloween, women approaching historical topics differently than men?
Well, I want to say that I think that this is a really good way to broach conversations in public and public history. And you're right. It is a great way to get into people's imagination and have something that's relevant. But I think it's also an important moment to discuss like how women can really change the conversation and how diversity in academia can change the conversation about how events are perceived. I mean, if this is something that's so popular in our memory, but if these, you know, if women hadn't acknowledged and discussed and written about, you know, the gendered aspects of the witchcraft trials about Salem, I mean, maybe we wouldn't have Hocus Pocus.
Ouch. Wow.
Well, you know what I'm saying? Like, it takes an actual, like, you have to acknowledge it first. I mean, because you have these men writing about it and they're just ignoring it. And it's like, well, wait a minute. This is happening disproportionately to women. So I think it's important to be able to flesh out the nuance of it, like Reese does, and not talk about it solely as it's just, you know, women are victims, but it's just, this is a product of something a little bit larger. So.
Right. Excellent.
What are your closing thoughts?
Closing thoughts on this. I mean, I love Halloween. I absolutely adore it. I love Hocus Pocus too. Although it's not really, I don't think objectively that good of a movie.
No.
You know, I love Reese's approach. Reese's is the one that kind of resounds the most with me. It resonates with me. Although I do like Sharp's kind of idea that you have to combine all of it. I like this idea. You talked about how, you know, diversity in academia really kind of changes the conversation, changes the questions we ask. I think Reese is early in this kind of movement to approach religion a little more on the terrain of historical subjects and not just be dismissive of it out of hand, which I think is really good. It's also this push to not be dismissive of the way women viewed themselves. Don't apply kind of our modern conceptions back on historical subjects.
Right. That's the most important.
It's a great, right. I mean, I think it's a great book. It's not very long either. And I would encourage listeners, if you've not read Elizabeth Reese Stamp, Women, Sinners and Witches in Puritan New England, I mean, pick it up. It's available. It's a good read. She does good history. It's a sound approach to kind of how you approach this seemingly well-worn historical topic, right?
Right.
Anyway, thank you so much, Hillary.
Thank you. Thanks for not playing too many sound effects.
I won't. One more wish. All right. I just wanted to thank our listeners for joining us for this introduction to an incomplete history. Be sure to join us every week for new episodes. You can subscribe through iTunes or wherever you manage to locate this podcast, as well as through our own website. The website is unincompletehistory.com. Everybody can post comments or questions on the website. If your question is something you'd like answered and it's relevant to an episode we do in the future, we'll definitely address that. We'll try to do our best to do that. Once again, I'm Jeff.
And I'm Hillary.
And we'd like to wish you well. Until next time.
Thanks for joining.